You're listening to the Author Stories Podcast, bringing you the story behind the stories and the storytellers.
Margaret White.
Terry Brooks.
Sheena Kamal.
Matthew Quick.
J.T. Ellison.
Walt D. Williams.
Brad Ford.
Corey Doctorow.
Brandon Sanderson.
Robin Mock.
Ernest Klein. Jim Butcher.
Sherilyn Harris.
Visit HankGarner.com for archives of all the shows. Today's guest is
Jeffrey Beaver.
Well, thanks for tuning in to Author Stories today. We've got a fantastic show for you. Go to HankGarner.com and subscribe to the show. Any way that you download podcasts, you can listen to it there. I'd like to talk about some sponsors before we get started. Scribophile is a respectful online writing workshop and writer's community. Writers of all skill levels join to improve each other's work with thoughtful critiques and by sharing their writing experience. We're the writing group to join if you want to find beta readers, get the best feedback around, learn how to get published, and be part of the friendliest and most successful writing workshop online. Improve your writing by receiving detailed critiques, learn from a vast collection of free writing resources, make lifelong friends in our busy community of writers. Writing is a solitary art, but that doesn't mean you have to be lonely. Lucky for you, there are thousands of writers on Scribophile every day, and we're a really friendly bunch. You've never seen a writing group like this one. Join Scribophile today at Scribophile.com. For the Words is a unique writing motivator unlike anything I've ever seen. For the Words is an online writing platform which motivates writers of all backgrounds to increase their word count through gamification. Writing can be challenging, especially when you need to consistently produce a high output of words. By injecting a little fun into that routine and using daily rewards to promote a healthy writing habit, For the Words makes it easier to reach those word count goals. We're a community of bloggers, professional authors, college and high school students, research scientists, gamers, and first-time writers from all over the world. Come for the words, stay for the fun. It's forthewords.com. That's the number four, thewords.com. Writers, the internet is one of the best tools for research and creativity, but it can also be one of the biggest hindrances to productivity, distracting you from doing the seat-in-chair, hand-on-keyboard work. Rescue Time gives you an accurate picture of how you spend your time to help you become more productive every day. Spot inefficiencies in your day and become better at managing your time. Create a goal, like spending less than 1 hour per day on email, to help you stay focused. Set an alarm to tell you when you spent more than 2 hours a day on Facebook. Try Rescue Time and use our special discount code for 30% off our Rescue Time premium account by going to rescuetime.com/author stories. Let us help you rescue your time. Before we get into today's interview with Jeffrey Deaver, we're going to play a special audiobook excerpt from his brand new book, The Never Game. Audio excerpted courtesy Penguin Random House from The Never Game by Jeffrey Deaver, narrated by Kaleo Griffith. Right after that, we'll jump into our interview with Jeffrey Deaver.
He asked the woman to repeat herself. "That thing they throw," she said, "with the burning rag in it."
"They throw?"
"Like at riots. A bottle. You see 'em on TV."
Coulter Shaw said, "A Molotov cocktail."
"Yeah, yeah," Carol was saying. "I think he had one."
"Was it burning, the rag part?"
"No, but, you know."
Carol's voice was raspy, though she wasn't presently a smoker that Shaw had seen or smelled. She was draped with a green dress of limp cloth. Her natural expression seemed to be one of concern, yet this morning it was more troubled than usual.
"He was over there," she pointed.
The Oakview RV park, one of the scruffier that Shaw had stayed at, was ringed with trees, mostly scrub oak and pine, some dead, all dry, and thick, hard to see over there. "You called the police?" A pause.
"No. If it wasn't a... what again?"
"Molotov cocktail."
"If he didn't have one, it'd be embarrassing. And I call the cops enough for stuff here."
Shaw knew dozens of RV park owners around the country, mostly couples, as it's a good gig for middle-aged marrieds. If there's just a single manager, like Carol, it was usually a she, and she was usually a widow. They tend to dial 911 for camp disputes more than their late husbands, men who often went about armed. "On the other hand," she continued, "fire. Here. You know." California was a tinderbox, as anybody who watched the news knew. You think of state parks and suburbs and agricultural fields. Cities, though, weren't immune to nature's conflagrations. Shaw believed that one of the worst brush fires in the history of the state had been in Oakland, very near where they were now standing.
"Sometimes I kick somebody out. They say they'll come back and get even."
She added with astonishment,
"Even when I caught them stealing 40 amps when they paid for 20. "Some people, really?"
he asked. "And you want me to..."
"I don't know, Mr. Shaw. Just take a look. Could you take a look, please?"
Shaw squinted through the flora and saw, maybe, motion that wasn't from the breeze. A person walking slowly? And if so, did the pace mean that he was moving tactically? That is, with some mischief in mind. Carol's eyes were on Shaw, regarding him in a particular way. This happened with some frequency. He was a civilian, never said he was anything else, but he had cop fiber. Shaw circled to the front of the park and walked on the cracked and uneven sidewalk, then on the grassy shoulder of the unbusy road in this unbusy corner of the city. Yes, there was a man in dark jacket, blue jeans, and black stocking cap, some 20 yards ahead. He wore boots that could be helpful on a hike through brush and equally helpful to stop an opponent. And yes, either he was armed with a gas bomb or he was holding a Corona and a napkin in the same hand. Early for a beer some places, not in this part of Oakland. Shaw slipped off the shoulder into the foliage to his right and walked more quickly, though with care to stay silent. The needles that had pitched from branch to ground in droves over the past several seasons made stealth easy. Whoever this might be, vengeful lodger or not, he was well past Carol's cabin. So she wasn't at personal risk. But Shaw wasn't giving the guy a pass just yet. This felt wrong. Now the fellow was approaching the part of the RV camp where Shaw's Winnebago was parked, among many other RVs. Shaw had more than a passing interest in Molotov cocktails. Several years ago, he'd been searching for a fugitive on the lam for an oil scam in Oklahoma, when somebody pitched a gas bomb through the windshield of his camper. The craft burned to the rims in 20 minutes, personal effects saved in the nick. Shaw still carried a distinct and unpleasant scent memory of the air surrounding the metal carcass. The percentage likelihood that Shaw would be attacked by two Russian-inspired weapons in one lifetime, let alone within several years, had to be pretty small. Shaw put it at 5%. A figure made smaller yet by the fact that he had come to the Oakland-Berkeley area on personal business, not to ruin a fugitive's life. And while Shaw had committed a transgression yesterday, the remedy for that offense would have been a verbal lashing, a confrontation with a beefy security guard, or at worst, the police, not a firebomb.
Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I'm really excited to have Jeffrey Deaver on the show with me. His brand new book is called The Never Game, and when you're hearing this, it is out everywhere in hardback, in audiobook, in Kindle, or ebook edition, wherever you buy your books, it is available now. Jeff, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Hank. A pleasure to talk to you.
I'm excited to have you on the show. I've been a longtime fan, and when I saw your new book releasing, I just knew that we had to get you on the show to talk about it. We begin each show with the same question, though, and that question is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller?
I remember it quite vividly. I was 11 years old and reading my father's James Bond novel. I have to be honest, I can't remember which one it was. I think it was Dr. No, which I think was Fleming's first Bond novel. It might have been From Russia with Love. But in any event, it was 1961, one of the Bond novels in paperback, a little Signet paperback, cost 25 cents. And I was in love with the idea of story. And I said, I'm going to try this. And I wrote I called it a novel. It was, of course, a short story, but I divided it into two chapters, so chapter one, chapter two, and I wrote the end at the end, and I did the cover art myself. I'm not an artist at all, but I have to say the art still was better than the book that I wrote, or the little short story I wrote, which was about a spy, believe it or not. And he parachuted into Russia to steal a super airplane at the time. That was, of course, the height of the Cold War. And so we had to steal the Russian, the Soviet airplanes. And it was terrible. And thank goodness it doesn't exist, because, you know, when you achieve a certain level of success, your publisher wants you to, you know, dredge up that early work. But thank goodness that it's gone. And even if I found it, I would shred it. But I knew then I wanted to be a writer. And my life is a full-time writer of fiction. And my life has been a journey to do that. I also knew that you cannot be a prodigy writer, even at a young age. You can't make a living. Well, I shouldn't say can't. There are exceptions. But generally, you have to live a while. You have to live life to experience things. And so I had other jobs. I was a journalist and an attorney, a singer, a songwriter for a little while. But basically, my goal always was to get back to that magic moment of being absorbed in stories, and in my case, learning to tell them.
Wow. I had an aunt who was a voracious reader, and she collected paperbacks all through the 60s, 70s, 80s, and passed down boxes of paperbacks to me. And some of those were those Ian Fleming novels. And I had a similar experience. There was, say what you want to about the books, they had this magical quality of just sucking you into the story. That's awesome. I love that.
And they were lean books too. They were not that, they were like 160 pages. And for the time, you think, your listeners may be thinking, what, an 11-year-old boy reading the James Bond books? They were very tame. That was the era when there were no bad words. The bedroom scenes that we cut away before we saw anything, there was very little, actually very little violence in them. So they were actually quite appropriate for people my age, but they were magical.
They were. So you go out to collect life experience, knowing that you want to come back one day. What was that that turnabout for you? What was it that brought you back to writing, and how did you know that you were ready?
It was, to be honest with you, a practical matter. I have never liked the idea of being a starving artist. I had jobs to support me. I wanted not luxuries in life by any means, but I wanted to be sure I could pay my bills, be responsible. And I also found that, when you have to struggle, your creativity suffers. This idea of the artist in the garret, you know, the freezing and starving up in the attic and, drinking and doing drugs and things. We have a responsibility to our audience. We need to make sure we write a book, or, you know, paint a painting or whatever your particular favorite form of art is. We have to make sure we do that as best we can. We writers get paid to make up stories for a living. It's just the best thing in the world. And so I wanted to make sure that I had my creature comforts taken care of. Again, nothing luxurious, but once that was settled, I was actually working as an attorney in Manhattan and writing on my commute. And I started to sell books. And at some point, my income for the books was pretty close to what I was making as an attorney. Now, I had, by that time, to get more hours to write, because working as an attorney in Manhattan takes many, many hours, I was working as a legal editor. I'd left my law practice to do that. So I was only working 8 hours a day and writing the rest of the time. But my income from the books just about equaled my income from the law. And I said, I took a deep breath and said, okay, let's take the leap. And I did, and never looked back. That was actually 30 years ago this year.
Wow. So what was that first book?
Well, the first book, now, that, again, that was before I left the law practice. I published six before I quit. And it was a, I don't know, let me think of, what would a literary critic say? Maybe the worst book written that decade. maybe there's a finer way to put that, but it was a book called Voodoo. And it was my one stab at the occult, because I love Stephen King's writing. I mean, no one is Stephen King.
Sure.
That's a truism, of course. But by that, I mean, he sits down with an idea, and you know, I don't know how many months later, out comes a lengthy, beautifully crafted book.
Sure.
And so I read almost all of his writing. And I thought horror, I wasn't really, aside from him, a big horror fan, but I thought I'd give it a shot. And, this is before The Walking Dead, before all the vampire books and so forth. Well, I mean, we had The Vampire Lestat. I think we had Bram Stoker's Dracula, of course. But I thought, I'll give it a shot. Nobody had ever done anything about the Santeria, the voodoo, the hoodoo, the Caribbean religion with the occult side. So I gave it a shot. And it didn't do particularly well. And when I went back and reread it, it was not well crafted at all. But there is something, an interesting phenomenon about the book world that you and maybe some of your listeners know, that first edition books can be worth quite a bit. And the first edition element, it means the first printing, not a revision, but the first printing. And the books like, you know, what am I thinking of? Like Tale of Two Cities, or a book by Charles Dickens, first edition, actually may not be worth a huge amount of money, as opposed to a very popular author. For instance, a first edition of J.K. Rowling's first Harry Potter is worth a huge amount of money now, whereas a first edition of Bleak House may not be worth that much. And it all has to do with the market. It doesn't have anything to do with the nature of the book itself. Well, that's a long story, but here's the bottom line. My first book was so bad, nobody bought it. The publisher shipped me three or four cartons of these books, and I still have them. And I looked on eBay not too long ago, and because they were so rare, had nothing to do with the quality, they're worth like $500 or $600 each. So I may not be a very good investor in the stock market. I may not make I may not make millions with the books, but I at least am able to retire on my first very bad book.
Well, and you have something to leave your loved ones that'll keep growing in value.
As long as they sell it. I love them too much to let them read the stupid book. But anyway.
Oh, that's so funny. That is so funny. Jeffrey, you have written more than 30 books in your career, many mysteries and thrillers. Do you hearken back to those Ian Fleming novels when you write? Do you get that feeling of adventure and of wanting to pull people into a story the way you were pulled into a story?
It's so important to craft a book that creates a roller coaster for the reader. Mickey Spillane, who was a writer of we call it pulp fiction. I'm not talking about the movie. I'm talking about the phenomenon of pulp fiction, which was paperbacks, primarily paperback originals written in the 40s, 50s, and early 60s, about kind of gritty private eyes, you know, dames and guys involved in shady dealings and so forth, tough cops. But Mickey Spillane, who wrote many, many books, a great writer, he said, you know, people don't buy a book to get to the middle.
Right.
They buy a book to get to the end. And it's our job as authors to grab the readers by the lapels in the opening scene and not let go until the very last scene. If somebody buys one of my books, and they say, oh, Jeff, I liked it. It was a pretty good book. I spent all summer reading it. I failed. I want my readers to pick up a book and have to finish it, if not that day, within a couple of days. And if I'm not doing that, I'm doing something wrong. So I, in a very calculated way, think very hard about what is going to get people to turn pages. And I've developed a formula for writing books, which we can, you know, chat about later if you like, that really keys into that goal of mine, that I don't want to write an interesting book. I want to write a, oh my gosh, my palms are sweating, what is going to happen next book? And I have people like Ian Fleming, as well as other authors that I loved growing up, people like Dashiell Hammett, and some of the non-crime writers as well, people like Ray Bradbury in science fiction, and Edgar Rice Burroughs, who wrote Tarzan and other series. Those were books that just, they were about story. They weren't about selling an agenda. They weren't about politics. They just moved the story along so that that could, you know, take us out of our daily cares and give us a couple hours or maybe a day's worth of just pure fun and tense relaxation, a roller coaster, in other words.
Well, tell us a little bit about that formula. How do you approach book writing that is guaranteed to keep us on that roller coaster?
This has taken me some years to figure out. My first books didn't sell particularly well. And then I got the idea that, I was at the time an attorney. Well, when you approach a case as an attorney or approach a business deal, it doesn't have to be litigation, you plan everything out ahead of time, every single thing. Despite what we see in the movies and TV, when the lawyers go into court, there are hardly ever any surprises. They know the answers to all the questions. And if they don't, they're not doing a very good job as an attorney. So I thought, why should I be any different in writing a book? Why should I not take my job any less seriously than an attorney takes her job or a brain surgeon takes his job? And so I decided to start outlining. Now, before I wrote the book, now the world of writing is divided into two categories. Those who outline, they're called the plotters, and those who don't, who just sit down and let the book go where it will, and those who call it the pantsers, as in seat of the pants. Well, I'm not a pantser, and God bless any author who can do that. George R. R. Martin, the writer of the Game of Thrones books, does not outline. I've heard him say that, and I certainly believe him. And obviously, he's a very successful author. Lee Child, a friend of mine, he does not outline the Jack Reacher books. Again, very successful. I just don't quite work that way. I need to get everything plotted out ahead of time. And also, my books do take place over a short period of time. There are three subplots going on at once, and I like my surprise endings. So I spend 8 months getting all of the, I call it a schematic, getting the schematic of the book done with all of those plots outlined on a big chart. I write in all, where all the clues are. I know where every character walks onto the stage, you might say, and when he or she leaves the stage, often vertically, sometimes horizontally, because not everybody survives the ending of my books, of course. And when the outline is done, in the Never Game, for instance, my outline was about 150 pages long, and it had every element of the book in it. And I during that 8 months when I'm doing the outline, I do the research too, get all the facts at my hand. And then at the when that's all finished, I sit down and I can write the book very quickly because I know where it's going to go. We hear about the concept of writer's block. I don't think there is writer's block. I think if you're blocked, and I mean completely blocked, I don't know how to get the characters into the car today, that, little technical things like that. But I mean, if you look at the middle of a book and you have no idea where you're going to go, there's a reason for that. And you should frankly just throw it out and start something else. Well, once the outline's done, I've worked through all that. I know where the story is going to go. Or in some cases, I look at the outline and the outline isn't going to go anywhere. I see that block in the middle of the outline and I throw out 20 or 30 pages, which is a lot easier than throwing out 400 pages of prose that you've written. But anyway, once that's done, I don't have any blocks. I sit down and write the book in any order I want, and out it comes in about 2 months. And then there's a lot of revision and polishing that goes into it. So that's basically my template for writing a book.
That is fantastic. And spending that amount of time in the pre-writing probably makes you super familiar with the story, almost like you're a character in the story, I'll bet.
That's a good point. I've never heard it put that way, but that's true. Now that you mentioned that, I'll share another aspect of my technique. I I was a journalist a long time ago, and I learned to touch type. And when I write the book, I look at my outline, and I see, okay, here's a scene where Coulter Shaw has to go to a video gaming convention, because the Never Game is set in the world of video games. And I say, okay, and I look at my research, and I have that all in my head. And then I shut the lights out or close my eyes, and I just imagine myself being there with him, and I type. I don't look at the screen. You know, I make mistakes, certainly, but I go back and correct that. So I envision it, and I hear the characters talking. You know, we authors are allowed to hear voices in our head. There's nothing right. wrong with that. It's not a sign of mental illness. I'm not speaking for all authors, but generally that's the rule. And so, I found that, I do really become part of the story. In fact, I was just at a conference not too long ago, and, somebody asked, how do you, dwell with the darkness? And I say, well, you know, the fact is the books look kind of sick and twisted, and I do get involved in the story. But at the end of the day, 5 o'clock or 6 o'clock, when it's time to knock off work, I pretty much put the bad guys away and just go upstairs and have a beer. I don't have to, sit in a corner hugging myself, saying, "Jeffrey, it's going to be okay. They're not real people." I'm at this stage, I'm pretty able to separate the two.
I love that. About 20 years ago, you wrote a book, The Bone Collector, which introduced us to a new character, Lincoln Rhyme. That book spun into a massively successful series, and that first book was made into a movie starring Denzel Washington. Amazing work. After writing that series for so long, I would imagine that you get very familiar with those characters, and I won't say that it probably gets easier as you go, but there are certain aspects of the storytelling that are inherently built in because you've already got fully alive, fleshed out characters.
You're absolutely right. No, it is easier, certainly easier. You don't have to reinvent things over and over again. For your listeners who may not be familiar with the Bone Collector, that was the movie starring Denzel Washington and Angelina Jolie. And it's about my hero, Lincoln Rhyme, is a quadriplegic forensic detective. He worked for the NYPD and was injured on the job. And he goes under medical retirement. But he comes back to become a consulting detective, just like Sherlock Holmes was. The books are set in the present day, of course, but like Sherlock Holmes did for Scotland Yard. And I know that character very, very, very well. I know Amelia Sachs, who was played by Angelina in the movie. There are both good sides and bad sides about that. The good side is you don't have to reinvent them once again.
Right.
But the bad side is that you better check your facts just to be sure, because you can't
yes.
have this hasn't happened, but I'd say that Amelia picked up her Glock in her left hand, because the readers would say, no, she's right-handed. How could you have her do that? So you do have to be a little bit careful. But I've been very pleased with the popularity of the movie, because it's gotten people interested in the book. And, to be honest, I've been active with the disabled community, because he's a quadriplegic. It's a severe disability, but he's also a hero. And I don't sugarcoat him. I don't put him up on a pedestal. He's a curmudgeon. He gets really angry about his condition. And yet he says, this is the way I am. Okay, you may, he points to another character. He said, you may have your issues about your physical inclination. Maybe you'd like to lose some weight, but you've got your body. I have my body. Our job is to, in his case, to solve crimes. And people really respond to that. In fact, we just learned last week that NBC is now picked up a Bone Collector series. The title is going to be Lincoln, because it's based not on the Bone Collector book, but of the 11 books in the series. And that's going to, the series will air first season this year, later this year on NBC. So we're very excited about that. But we can see that this character is someone that readers and viewers really respond to because of his heroism. And the fact is that, you know, we do get a little tired, I have to say, of these superhero characters. And I don't mean necessarily the Marvel superhero characters, but the thriller action-adventure heroes who can do no wrong, who can leap tall buildings, who can shoot straighter than anybody else. And Lincoln Rhyme is an intellectual hero. He uses his mind as his weapon. And I think people have enjoyed that.
Which brings me to Coulter Shaw, your protagonist in The Never Game. This is a new series. So you wipe the slate clean, and all of the things that you have built and put together for the Bone Collector series, all that's off the table. And you're creating an entirely new world with a new protagonist who also is not, he's not a perfect guy. He's not that, he's not the Jack Reacher, if you will, to borrow from Lee Child, who we were talking about earlier, who, you know, you always know that what's going to come out of Reacher. But Coulter is a different kind of guy and in a different situation altogether. What was the inspiration for this book?
Many years ago, I wrote a three-book series featuring a fellow named John Pelham, and he was a location scout for a film company. He traveled around the country to look for spots to shoot films. And he was an amateur private eye who would, you know, come into town and there'd be a crime and he'd get involved in it. You never wanted to be John Pelham's sidekick, you know, in a Tom Hanks movie. You don't want to be his buddy, because we know what's going to happen in the opening scene. The buddy gets killed, of course. His wingman gets killed. So, and then John Pelham would solve the crime. Well, those were murder mysteries. They weren't thrillers. They were slow moving. They were popular. They were nominated for some awards, but, the books being set in Hollywood is kind of a, you know, to be honest, it's a goofy place. We kind of make fun of the players, as in The Player, the movie and the book, if you're familiar with that. There was Get Shorty, both the movie and TV show. So it's kind of easy to laugh at Hollywood. So that series I didn't want to pursue, but I always had it in the back of my mind. I want an itinerant hero. I want somebody who can come to town with the intent of solving the crime and then leaving, but not being a cop. I don't want them to do police procedurals. So somehow I heard about the idea of a reward being offered by either the police or by private individuals for maybe a missing person, for an escaped convict, a terrorist that no one can find. And so I created a hero, Coulter Shaw, who travels around the country in his Winnebago to look for these rewards. Now, it's not, he makes his living that way, but it's not really about the money. And in fact, in some of the stories, he doesn't even take the reward, or he takes it and he gives it away to a good cause. What he likes about the reward is that it means there's a problem that no one has been able to solve. Because if they could, there wouldn't be the reward. And that means it stymied the police and maybe stymied a family whose daughter has gone missing, his son has gone missing, and the police aren't as involved as they should be in finding that person. And so Shaw is a self-described restless man. He needs something to engage him all the time. And so he travels around the country and pursues these rewards. In The Never Game, the first in the series, he goes out to Silicon Valley to look for a young woman who's been abducted, it appears, by someone obsessed with a video game and is acting out that video game in real life. Now, this is a video game I made up, and it involves a villain in the game who basically kidnaps somebody and hides them in an abandoned location and then gives them five objects. And they need to use those five objects to kind of MacGyver-like escape. And if they don't, the bad guy comes back and comes back to kill them. And so it's a race against time, like all of my books. Coulter has to figure out how to play the game, basically, and track down the villain before he strikes again.
How did you prepare yourself to write about this world of online gaming and this kind of a fantasy world inside of the fantasy world you created?
I'm not a gamer person. I remember some games. I think I had Pong back in the 70s, which was a ball bouncing back and forth. And, I guess I tried my hand at Pac-Man and can't even think of some of the others back in the 70s and early 80s. But a few years ago, I was playing a video game with my niece, and I'd never seen it before. She said, Uncle Jeff, this is Minecraft. Let's play. And I said, oh, okay, sure. How do you play? And she said, well, here, you load it on your phone and I've got it on my phone. And we were connected via Wi-Fi or whatever it was, whatever system it was. And, I said, how do we play? And she said, like this. And then she pulled out a sword. Her character pulled out a sword and stabbed me to death, in the first, the first like 10 seconds. I thought it was a bit unsporting because I'd never played. And she, of course, being a 9-year-old, played these games all the time. And I laughed, of course. And then, she told me what to do. And we had some fun playing the game. But basically, I was so happy that happened because I thought, well, what an idea. Somebody takes the video game and gets a little obsessed with it, as I learned people do, and takes it into the real world. And so I did a lot of research into video games and was astonished to find that it's an industry bigger than Hollywood. In America, 200 million people play. It's 2/3 of our population play video games regularly. They play on computer, but smartphones now the biggest growing platform. And if you walk, I sometimes on an airplane, I fly 100,000 miles a year. I'm booked to and research things. So I always go to the restroom in the back, even if I don't need to, so I can see what people are doing, hoping they read books. And many people are reading books, but many people are playing video games. And it was really quite eye-opening to me to see them staring down at the little screens and playing. Some are, just kind of the mindless time-wasting games. Some are games that where you learn skills. Some are, combat-oriented games. And so I thought, well, this is something I just have to write a book about. And so Colter Shaw gets a bit of an education in the gaming world, too.
Well, the book is The Never Game. It is absolutely fantastic. Jeffrey, you have outdone yourself again. If people are just learning about you and all of the work that you've done, is there a place where they can connect with you online to dig into your back catalog and follow along with news coming up?
Oh, you bet. JeffreyDeaver.com is my website, and I have a very active Facebook and Twitter presence, Jeffrey Deaver on Facebook and at Jeffrey Deaver on Twitter. And I look forward to visiting in person with some of your listeners at my my book event. So please check out that schedule and come by and say hi.
Excellent. Jeff, thank you so much for taking time to come on the show. We're going to send everybody to see you and to pick up their copy of The Never Game.
Thank you, Hank. A real pleasure.
Thanks for listening to the Author Stories Podcast. For more great author interviews like this one, go to hankgarner.com and dig through the archives. There's something there I know you'll love. Now stay tuned for a special audio clip from Richard Gleaves' The Jason Crane series.
Didn't your dad teach you not to trespass? Yeah. Sorry, I'll go. Joey stepped forward, but Hedwig remained motionless, blocking the only exit. No, 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 no. Someone needs to learn a lesson about respecting other people's property. Joey felt unnerved and panicky. Please, Hedwig. Mr. Van Brunt. Please, Mr. Van Brunt. May I go now? Please? Not such a smartass now, are you? His voice grew flat and contemptuous. You little bastards think you run the world, but you have no idea. No idea where your food comes from, what your parents have to go through to put clothes on your back. Humiliating jobs, long hours, going gray, to provide for you. What are you talking about? Life. Real life. You think it's easy, don't you? Don't you? Those stupid adults doing their stupid adult things while you play all day. Well, it's hard. You hear me? It's hard. Joey's breath caught. He knew what Hedwig was capable of. What did you do to Jason?
Nothing.
Where is he then?
Jason's run away from home.
I don't believe you. I don't care what you believe. I'm the adult. I ask the questions. What did you do to my son?
To Zeph?
Is Zeph okay?
No,
he's not. Zeph is not okay. And it was you, wasn't it? You're the one who did it.
Who did what?
Who twisted his mind. I haven't done anything to Zeph. Don't lie to me!
Hedwig raised a hand, and a fireball blossomed there. Joey had never seen Hedwig's gift before. The man held a piece of hell. His face looked like something carved from driftwood, full of cracks and crevices. His eyes were shadowed and vacant, but glittering with flame, like knotholes full of fireflies. Yeah, someone's mind had twisted, but not Zeph's.
Hedwig's gone batshit.
Hedwig passed the fireball from one hand to the other.
Did Zeph send you for his things? I know you know where he is. He said he was in love with you.
Hedwig made it sound as if Zeph had confessed to murder.
Is that true?
I don't know.
Hedwig broke into a wide grin.
Well, we can find out, can't we? He's a pinchin, right?
A pinchin would know.
Know what? You're not making sense. It's their gift.
The pinchin gift?
My son's a pinchin, like his whore of a mother. And pinchins are telepaths. They always know when the people they love are in danger.
Joey's eyes had gone wide. He blinked, trying to process the information.
Zeph had a gift?
For sure? They have a psychic alarm. If you hurt someone they love, they come running.
He raised the fireball.
So let's find out. Let's find out if Zeph really loves you. Let's see if he's a fag or not. I know he's not. You'll see. He won't feel a thing when I do it.
When you do what?
When I burn you black.
Joey went cold. Hedwig meant it.